listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We live in a world that's radically different from the one our ancestors evolved in. The result is at times a mismatch between ourselves and our environment, and according to Daniel E. Lieberman, a professor of human biology at Harvard, that mismatch has contributed to the growing incidence of disease and chronic illness in the industrialized world. His book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease, explores how we came to be furless, big-brained bipeds who dominate the world, and how that dominance might be our undoing. It's published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
I live in Brooklyn, far from where my Paleolithic ancestors lived, and interact with all kinds of modern conveniences. Came here on the subway. There are I take medicines. There's refrigeration here. But is my body pretty much adapted for life as a hunter-gatherer in the Serengeti?
Well, yes and no. It's complicated. I mean, our evolutionary history, which, you know, of course, occurred over millions, even billions of years, adapted us for many things. It's only recently that people have even started farming, and even more recently that people started living lives like you and I do, and taking public transportation and living in cities. And in some ways, we are thriving, right? More people are alive today than ever before, and we live longer, and arguably we're healthier than we ever have been before. But there are also a growing number of diseases, chronic, non-infectious diseases, like heart disease and many forms of cancer, that are also on the rise, that are occurring partly because we are not totally adapted for the world in which we live.
And you're right. These are paradoxical times for our bodies.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Because it's often known as the epidemiological transition. So as infectious disease is decreasing and death from inadequate nutrition, there has been a concomitant increase in non-communicable, and non-infectious diseases. And many of these are indeed mismatch diseases, and many of them are just also, they don't kill you, but they just cause misery and discomfort, like myopia or flat feet or hemorrhoids or you know, there's a long list of things that are occurring to our bodies that probably didn't occur as much in the old days as they do now.
But, of course, we've developed medicines to handle all of that, and I have snow boots to take care of trudging through the muck and mire that New York City streets are like right now. I'd imagine that my ancestors would have been less protected. How much has my biology changed since the Ice Age?
Well, that's one of the most important questions we can ask today, actually, because, you know, evolution, sometimes people think that evolution just stopped, you know, when our species evolved. But, of course, that's not the case. Evolution is still going on today. But there's, you know, natural selection is the outcome of variation. So everybody looks different from each other. Heritability. So some of those variations are the result of genes that we inherited from our parents, and differential reproductive success, that some individuals have more offspring than other offspring. And those, the outcome of those three variables, those three phenomena is natural selection. So it by definition must still be going on today.
Well, we're not threatened by to be eaten by lions, but isn't being hit by a bus still a form of selection?
It could be. So if there are variations that you have that are, you know, heritable, that make you more or less likely to be hit by a bus, then indeed selection is going to still operate, which brings me to the other point I was going to mention, which is that the other form of evolution that's going on is cultural evolution, right? We've invented all kinds of things in our world today. And culture changes our environment. And as a result, it changes the selective forces acting on us. A simple example would be that when our ancestors invented fancy clothing, such as you and I wore today to get to where we were going in this snowstorm, that enabled human beings to live in environments which we were not initially adapted for. So by being able to move into temperate environments, things like clothing and fire and dwellings, enabled natural selection to then operate in other ways, for example, for some populations to become more light-skinned or more tolerant of cold.
Yeah, but
so,
why do
so
we...
selection, both selection act together. They interact. Cultural evolution and biological evolution are not independent. They're actually deeply woven together.
Now, why did we become less hairy? In fact, hairiness seems to be rarer in cold climates. I would think that we would have retained that to keep ourselves warm.
Well, fur is a very useful adaptation that, of course, all our ancestors had once upon a time. For a number of things. Fur, of course, not only is it attractive, so it helps us attract mates in many species, but it also protects your skin from bites during aggression or fights or whatever. It also acts as a kind of radiator, so it's like a hat for your whole body that reflects radiation. So we lost our fur, we don't know exactly when, but after we became bipeds probably, possibly because of running, because fur interferes with sweating, and we cool down by sweating, whereas other animals cool down primarily by panting. And it may have also enabled some of our ancestors to walk long distances while they were foraging in the middle of the day when other carnivores that would normally predate upon us, eat us, were unable to hunt us. So we evolved furlessness a long time ago, probably in Africa millions and millions of years ago, and then we've retained that basic condition, right? And we can't just, you know, wave a wand and say, "Oh, well, we'd like the fur back, please." Evolution doesn't work that way. It's contingent. So what happens in the past creates or constrains or the variation upon which natural selection can operate on in the present.
But what you said about sweating confuses me a bit, because people, Scandinavians, are less likely to have facial hair than Mediterranean people. Who tend to be rather hairy and live in areas where they're going to sweat a lot more.
Well, none of us are really very hairy. I mean, what we're looking at is secondary sexual characteristics, hair that emerges on people's faces because of testosterone, a kind of testosterone in the skin. But that's, you know, there's a little bit of beard, etc. But that's not like another mammal like my dog or a polar bear, which is covered with fur. No humans have fur, except on the top of our heads, and we have a little bit of hair in our pubic areas and occasionally some secondary sexual hair, such as on our faces. It's not fur. It's very different. And so even the Scandinavian or the African or the Asian, you know, people from all over the planet cool primarily by sweating. And one of the advantages of fur is that or disadvantages of fur, if you're going to sweat, is that sweat works by evapotranspiration. So when you have the water goes from liquid to gas on the skin, that actually ends up cooling the skin and hence the blood below. And all of us primarily cool that way, no matter where we live.
Bipedalism is one of the many key traits that separate us from other primates. Do you know why humans began to walk upright on two legs?
Well, that's one of the most interesting questions that's still of enormous debate. But I think there are two most compelling theories. So one is that we know that bipedalism evolved very early on. Maybe it was the factor that caused our lineage to split from the chimpanzee lineage sometime around 6 million years ago. And one possibility was that early bipeds had a feeding advantage. They were better able to sort of feed in branches for fruits and things that were high up.
Because their hands were freed?
Yeah, and also they could sort of reach up and get to other, you know, when chimps feed, they often feed standing up in a branch, or orangutans do. But I think a more compelling explanation is that we evolved from creatures that were knuckle walkers. So think about a chimpanzee when it walks. It has very long forelimbs and short hind limbs, which help it be a tree climber. But those long forelimbs are kind of a problem when it's walking on all four legs, and it has to curl its fingers up underneath its hand to walk on its knuckles as a way of kind of help coping with the fact that it's got this long hand. And knuckle walkers, it turns out, for various reasons, are very expensive. A chimpanzee spends about four times more energy per unit body mass, per unit distance, walking than a bipedal human. And because we evolved from creatures that probably looked very much like chimpanzees, becoming bipeds may have enabled our ancestors to save a huge amount of energy if they were traveling long distances to get food. So a chimpanzee spends about 300 calories to walk 2 or 3 kilometers, which is what a chimpanzee typically walks today. For the same amount of energy, a human can walk 12 kilometers. It's a huge advantage when food becomes more dispersed as rainforests are shrinking during the period in which we split from chimpanzees.
But doesn't walking on two legs also cause us problems? Is chronic back pain a result of bipedalism? Do chimpanzees ever suffer from sciatica?
Exactly. Everything has trade-offs. There's no such thing as a free lunch in evolution. And so the advantage of bipedalism may have been it helped our ancestors get food, but there are trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs was this lumbar curve that we have that curves our lower back to position our center of mass above our hips. And we all know that we get problems. But natural selection has also helped us deal with them. So we showed in a paper a few years ago that you know how when women are pregnant, they have this huge mass in front of them, and they often lean back, right, to stabilize themselves. Well, it turns out that women, females, millions of years ago in the human lineage evolved adaptations to help deal with the extra load on the spine that occurs in pregnant women during you know, to carry that huge fetal load. So yes, bipedalism has brought us advantages, but it's also brought us disadvantages, which have then led to, in some cases, more selection.
My guest is Daniel E. Lieberman, Professor of Human Evolutionary Biology and the Edwin M. Lerner II Professor of Biological Sciences at Harvard. His book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease. What about teeth? Are our teeth unique in the world of primates?
Yes and no. I mean, we have standard sort of ape teeth in many regards, but we've also changed them in various ways over evolution. So our canines shrank. So if you look at a chimpanzee or gorilla, it's got very large canines. And today, the only people with really big canines are people pretending to be Dracula on movies.
Let me stop you there for a second. Does the fossil record suggest that when modern humans evolved, they had larger canines?
Were
the teeth pretty much the same as they are today?
Our teeth started shrinking millions of years ago, and by the time, by 2 million years ago, you know, if a Homo erectus were to walk into a dentist's office, if the dentist only saw his or her teeth, he wouldn't even notice it was a Homo erectus. I mean, our teeth have basically became very modern around 2 million years ago, but we do have some specialties in our teeth. One is that we have very thick enamel, which we evolved millions of years ago to chew really low-quality food. We lost our canines. Our front teeth, our incisors, also got smaller. So our teeth have adapted along with the rest of our body for particular kinds of diets.
Has that made us more susceptible to cavities?
Well, no. Actually, what cavities...
I mean, because it's changed, making us more susceptible to cavities?
Exactly. So cavities are caused by... the bacteria that normally live in our mouth. So we have a microbiome in our bodies. It turns out that your typical human, you and I, have about 10 times more cells that aren't us than there are us. Excuse me, 100 times more cells that aren't us than us. Your gut, your digestive tract is filled with other organisms, and they're including in your mouth, and they form the plaque on your teeth. Plaque is normal. Every animal pretty much has plaque. Chimpanzees have plaque. Our ancestors had plaque. The problem is that the bacteria in plaque love to eat carbohydrate. And when you eat a diet that's very high in simple starches and in sugar, those bacteria then go wild. They eat a lot of that stuff. And then the acid that they produce as a byproduct of digesting that sugar then builds up holes in our teeth because the plaque is sort of sealed in by a film. So our modern diets, when we started farming and eating more cereals and more sugar and more starch, we started feeding those bacteria, which are now wreaking havoc in our mouth, creating cavities. So cavities used to be extremely rare before people started eating a lot of cereals before the agricultural revolution. Now, of course, we have billions and billions of cavities on the planet, and it's an example again of that kind of mismatch.
Daniel E. Lieberman is our guest. His book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease, it's published by Pantheon. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Daniel E. Lieberman, Professor of Human Evolutionary Biology and the Edwin M. Lerner II Professor of Biological Sciences at Harvard. His book is The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease, published by Pantheon. You suggest that if Neanderthals or Denisovans had survived instead of us, that they would still be hunter-gatherers. Why?
Oh, well, that's just a speculation. It's interesting. If you look at the evidence for Neanderthals and what they did, I mean, they're clearly very smart creatures. They were very effective hunter-gatherers. They were able to live in Europe during the Ice Age. But nothing ever changes in the Neanderthal world, right? From the time they first appear 200,000 years ago to the time they go extinct 30,000 years ago, it's almost as if their tools never change. Their lifestyle never really changes. Very modest changes. And when modern humans move into Europe and encountered Neanderthals, they didn't seem to really change that much. Maybe a little bit, but never really quite the way humans change. So it appears that they didn't have quite the same ability to be culturally innovative the way we do. And that may have been the advantage that humans have over Neanderthals. But of course, it's just speculation. It's very hard to test those hypotheses.
Do we assume they had language?
Oh, I'm sure they did because, I mean, after all, they had huge brains and they were very sophisticated. Their brains were as large as ours, in fact, slightly larger. And brains are a big cost. The only reason to have a big brain is to be smart. And so they must have had some form of language and communication. But it may be there is some evidence that their ability to speak might not have been as clear as us, so that their ability to produce vowels that could be easily interpreted without error. So the perceptual errors, for example, in speech may have been higher in Neanderthals. Those are all, again, really hard to reconstruct because we can only rely on fossils rather than what you really want, which are, tape recordings or video recordings of what Neanderthals were doing. So it's difficult to be ever sure about why humans are here and why Neanderthals are not.
Well, I've always assumed that our large brains were an important element driving our dominance over the planet, but you say Neanderthals had larger brains. So
they did.
What's the difference? I mean, isn't brain size a really important factor here?
It's probably very important, but, it's also the structure of your brain. So one hypothesis is that what really makes humans different from Neanderthals is not our brain size, but the relative size of various components of the brain. So there's some hints, for example, that the temporal lobe is relatively larger in humans than in Neanderthals. And the temporal lobe is very important in language and in memory and in integrating various kinds of information in your brain. Another important difference may be the way we grow up. So we have a very long, slow childhood, right? It takes us a long time to go through adolescence and become adults. There are some hints. We don't have enough data yet, but there's some hints that adolescence and that juvenile phase might have been a little bit shorter in Neanderthals. And what happens during that phase? Well, that's after you've grown your brain to its adult size, but our kids are sort of pruning their brains. So my daughter, for example, is a teenager. I hope she doesn't listen to the show because she'll get very angry. But typical teenager, she's very bad at planning. She forgets to bring her lunch to school even after she's made it. Though that partly is because the prefrontal cortex, this region in the front of her brain, isn't yet at adult configuration. She's still got too many neurons there. She's got to get rid of some of the extra neurons she's not using. And that long adolescence that we have may enable us to prune our brains better so that they function more effectively. And so it's a hypothesis again that Neanderthals, by having not having our lengthy, long period of development, might not have been able to sort of build as good a brain as we have.
So our brains reshape themselves at the end of adolescence. Is that the reason why we start seeing certain mental illnesses like schizophrenia?
That's right.
That age?
Exactly.
Does that occur
right.
in other animals?
Not to my knowledge, but how would you, it's very hard to figure out many of these diseases in animals because they don't manifest their behaviors in the same way as we do. But also their brains aren't quite as complex. So yes, there's a hypothesis that many of these diseases like schizophrenia are more common in regions of the brain that evolved more recently because there have been less selection to kind of stabilize those parts of the brain.
Now, you note that an infant monkey is born with about 3% body fat. Humans are born with about 15% body fat.
We're fat.
And are we hardwired to crave foods filled with salt, sugar, and fats?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, having energy on board is incredibly important for all animals, but turns out to be of a special importance in human evolution because of our big brains and because of that long childhood. So a chimpanzee mother, for example, has an infant about every 5 or 6 years. She has another kid after her kid has grown up and able to forage for itself. But humans are able to have babies every 3 years in hunter-gatherer societies. And that means that, you know, a 3-year-old can't forage for itself. A 6-year-old can't forage for itself. Not even a 10 or 12-year-old can really get enough food for itself. So human parents have to produce lots of food for their offspring. And that requires having lots, particularly if you're a mother, lots of energy on board so you can continue producing lots of milk. So fat is a very important form of storing energy. So if you're a mother and you need to pay for this big-brained infant, and brains are very costly, and you need to pay for your infant plus you need to feed your toddlers and your older children, you need a lot of energy to kind of overcome any time periods when you're not getting in enough every day. If you went through days of not getting enough energy as much as you're spending, unless you have serious reserves, you're going to go extinct. So humans evolved because of our big brains and our long development to have extra stores of energy.
You write that the development of agrarian societies intensified the selection of certain genes. What kinds of genes? Yeah.
Well, we don't know entirely. So the hunt is on, right? So people are really looking for those genes. But there's certainly genes. Many of the genes are involved with infectious disease, because once we started becoming farmers, we started living permanently in villages and amidst our filth, you know, which were sort of leaving around us. So infectious disease rose after farming, and also because of living with animals. We started domesticating animals and living with them. And a huge number of really serious diseases like smallpox, etc., all arose because of our close association with animals. So we have a lot of genes that evolved since farming.
And then the plagues.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of genes arose because of all the diseases that we brought upon ourselves from farming. Other genes were selected for because of our changes in diet. So a very simple example would be the ability to digest milk after childhood. So most animals, after they stop weaning, they lose the ability to produce the enzyme lactase that breaks down the sugar in milk called lactose. But in 7 different human populations that domesticated animals independently evolved the ability to produce that enzyme after weaning so that we can drink milk as adults. That's clearly an example of selection caused by agriculture.
My guest is Daniel E. Lieberman. His book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease, it's published by Pantheon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, food is becoming industrialized now, and in the supermarket we can find an array of highly processed, calorie-rich foods. You write that processing, even simple grinding, changes the way our digestive systems function.
Yeah. So your enzymes, the way they break down food in your body is to, you know, they basically sort of attack the food, basically, and break it down. So if you just take a banana or anything and you grind it up into smaller particles, you increase the surface area of those particles relative to their volume. And that means that your digestive system can break them down faster. That's why we also evolved chewing millions of years ago, so that mammals can get more food out of their energy than, say, a reptile. So once we started processing our food, we were able to get more energy out of that food as it passes through our digestive tract. And, of course, we've also started adding stuff to our food as well. Sugar is in everything now today. I mean, it's very hard to find. You know, we pay extra for foods that haven't had sugar added to them. and one of the problems with our digestive systems is that we never evolved to handle sugar in the kinds of doses that we get today. So if you eat, say, a piece of fruit, you know, millions of years ago, it would have sugar in it, of course, but that sugar would be inside cells with lots of fiber in it, right? So you have to break down those cells. It would take and the fiber in the fruit not only slows the rate at which you get that sugar, but also slows the rate decreases the amount of sugar there is per unit volume. Now, of course, we have sugar without fiber. We just overdose our systems, both in terms of the 2 major kinds of sugar, fructose and glucose, and we get sick.
Are you suggesting we switch to the paleo diet that's become so popular?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are good things about the paleo diet, and there are things I'm not really very fond of in the paleo diet. I mean, there is no question that the healthiest diets out there all involve low-carbohydrate, low-sugar diets. I mean, there's just we're clearly poorly adapted to eating lots of carbohydrates, of simple carbohydrates, and we're very poorly adapted to handling lots of sugar. So I agree with that about the paleo diet. The paleo diet is also, I think, rather sensible about a number of other foods. But the paleo diet also argues that if our ancestors didn't eat it, we should need it too. So the paleo diet, for example, prohibits dairy. It prohibits legumes. Prohibits cereals altogether, and I think that's going a little bit too extreme. I mean, after all, my ancestors evolved the ability to digest milk. Why shouldn't I? I have some milk occasionally. What's wrong with lentils and peanuts? You know, I'm sure we'll get lots of angry responses from some paleo diet folks. But it's equating the idea that a diet that's ancestral must be better for ourselves. Plus, there's also
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, there's one other really important point about the paleo diet, which is that it makes the assumption that if we evolve to eat it, it must be healthy. And it's very important to remember that evolution only selects for health insofar as health promotes reproduction. We didn't evolve really to be healthy. We evolved to have lots of children who survived to then have children. So just because our ancestors ate something doesn't mean it's necessarily healthy for us.
And it seems to have worked that way. The human population has exploded in the last few hundred years.
Yeah, you can't argue with the results. I mean, we're doing very well. But as you mentioned before, we have this paradoxical situation. We're living longer. We're healthier in many ways. But we're also sicker in other ways. And my point is that by thinking about evolution thoughtfully and looking at the whole span of evolution rather than just some snapshot and understanding the logic of evolution, we can do better, and we can especially do better in terms of prevention because we spend too much time treating the symptoms of diseases rather than addressing their causes. And to treat the symptom of a disease, you need to know why it occurs. If you want to know why something occurs, you have to address it from an evolutionary perspective. Only evolution explains why things are the way they are.
And a listener, Rona from Merrick, asks about how allergies evolved.
Great question. So we have immune systems that evolved to be very busy. You know, the world is full of germs and worms and all kinds of tough stuff out there. And until recently, our immune systems had to function really in high gear. And recently, however, because of antibiotics, soaps, and sterilization and all kinds of things, which are, for the most part, very good, we've kind of removed all those demands on our immune system. But they're still there. The immune system you have and I have is more or less the same as the immune system of somebody from a few thousand years ago before Listerine and all that. And the result is that we have these cells in our immune system that are just hanging around in our body like teenagers, you know, waiting to get into trouble. And they sometimes pick the wrong target. So they get upset about peanuts or gluten or eggs or some protein that they shouldn't, and then amount to a allergic response, which then heightens the body's readiness for the next time you eat the same food, and then we get into trouble to get allergies.
Scientists have ascertained that Neanderthals gave us some genes that have led to diabetes, modern diabetes. So isn't that something that goes back pretty long time, or are we seeing new types of diabetes as a result of the modern diet?
Yeah, so that information has not been conveyed very well to the public. I'll make a bet that not a single Neanderthal had diabetes, or if they did, it was maybe one in like 10 million Neanderthals. It's that the genes that made them, that make certain human beings more prone to diabetes may be ancient, but the environments in which those genes interact with are very recent. And so all diseases are a result of gene-environment interactions. And what's changed really in recent period is the environments, not the genes. So some people, yes, do have genes that make them more prone to getting diseases such as diabetes, but their ancestors didn't get diabetes very often. It's us who are getting them because we're eating these high-sugar, high-fiber diets. Low-fiber diets.
The World Health Organization released a report recently which concluded that human cancer cases are expected to surge 57% worldwide in the next 20 years.
Correct.
What's driving such a high rate of cancer? And I mean, I understand Alzheimer's to some degree is linked to the fact that we're living longer. Is that true for cancer as well?
Well, cancer is a very complicated group of diseases. Each cancer is different, really. Some cancers certainly are occurring because people are living longer. And as you live longer, you're more likely to develop mutations that can lead to cancer. But some cancers, for example, many of the reproductive tissue cancers, are a result of energy. So your body, when it takes in energy, has only so many things you can do with it, right? You can spend that energy on growing, which you only do up till you're, what, 18 or 20. You can spend it on maintaining your body, fighting disease, things like that. You can spend it on, you can store it as fat, or you can spend it on reproduction. And what happens is that we, as we have more energy to spend because we're eating more and we're also spending less fighting disease and so on, we store that energy and we devote it to our reproductive tissue. So estrogen levels go up. Testosterone levels go up as you have more food, and those are mitogens, and they cause, you know, higher rates of breast cancer. They cause higher rates of prostate cancer. On top of that, you add the fact that women today have access to birth control. So they, you know, a typical hunter-gatherer female had only maybe 150 menstrual cycles in her life. A typical American woman will have 400 menstrual cycles in their life. And every time you have a menstrual cycle, you flood your body with these hormones that are increase your risk of cancer, because everything has trade-offs. So I'm not saying people shouldn't use birth control, but we have trade-offs in our world for the high-energy environments in which we live, the low reproductive rates in which we experience, and the result is an increase in cancer. So cancer is really very much a disease of affluence, and it very much hits people in developed nations, or as nations are becoming wealthier, cancer rates are going up all around the planet.
Isn't meat eating also a result of affluence? Although our ancestors ate meat, don't we eat a much higher percentage of it than they would have?
Well, actually, not so much. So it depends on which group you look at. There's no one paleo diet. There are many paleo diets, and it depends on where individuals were living. For example, the Inuit in the Arctic are eating huge amounts of meat, but they're also eating a lot of fish, which has a lot of protective oils. Hunter-gatherers in, say, Africa, many of them eat maybe 25 to 30% of their calories from meat, which is probably not too different from your average American. But one of the big differences is that the meat that we eat today is much less healthy than the game that our ancestors used to eat. There's a lot more saturated fat. The kinds of fatty acids are much less healthy. It's also what you eat the meat with that's also important. So and again, remember, meat was important for evolutionary history, but just because our ancestors evolved to eat meat, it wasn't because it was that meat was healthy. It's that meat helped our ancestors survive and reproduce. So remember, just because our ancestors ate something doesn't mean it makes us healthy. And that's, again, this serious logical flaw with some ways in which some people think about the paleo diet.
Professor Lieberman, we have no time left, but I've been thinking about this. The things that have made us such a successful species may also be our undoing today. We live in an environment that's still going through lots of transformations at a faster rate than any time in our history. Climate change, ocean acidification, just two major problems, not to mention pollution of our water, our air, our food. Will humans be able to adapt to the new Earth that we're rapidly creating, or are we likely to go extinct?
I hope the former, because I do believe that we are a species that is very capable of solving problems. And what we need to wake up to is that our evolutionary history helps us understand not how just to treat the symptoms of the problems that we cause, but also to stop causing them in the first place. And really, that's where I think the power of evolution lies. Evolutionary thinking helps us think about how to, you know, why things are the way they are, and how we can stop this vicious cycle of simply treating the symptoms of diseases, but rather prevent their causes. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we got more people exercising and eating healthy diets rather than simply having to treat the heart disease and the cancers and the diabetes that they get? And I think an evolutionary perspective can help us do that.
Daniel E. Lieberman is professor of human evolutionary biology and the Edwin M. Lerner's the second professor of biological sciences at Harvard. His book, The Story of the Human Body, Evolution, Health, and Disease, is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.